Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's photo show. As you can tell from the screen, we have a full house tonight. Not only our two experts, Damien and Ian. Good evening, guys.
Hi, good evening.
We also have Neil returning for another discussion. I think he might kind of sneak in something about that other camera lot, Nikon or Nikon or something like that. So we'll get to that. And our other guest, our most important guest tonight, is Sarah Longings. Welcome, Sarah. Thanks for turning up to our show. Hopefully you're in for a bit of fun and a bit of entertainment, but then we're going to make you work really hard in the third section. We want to know all about you, your photographs, and how and why you're so interested in photography. So welcome to tonight's show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, great. Right, so we have a packed show. Let's move straight into the section about this week's news items that we've been discussing. Okay, so news items this week have been quite fast and varied. The one we thought we'd get started with was something that we saw in the last show. You might remember we discussed about getting started in photography, and maybe you should think about secondhand cameras might be the way to go. So, Ian, you found an absolute humdinger, didn't you?
Yeah, absolute bargain. So a prototype Nikon L-Ranger Finder camera went for a whopping $468,850 at auction.
Great
bargain. It looks, and the best bit about it is it looks a bit beat up as well. So
not much chance of street robbery then.
No, it's not. It's not one previous owner, I don't think. It's
were you gutted you didn't get to bid on it?
Yeah, I'm always looking out for Nikon cameras, obviously.
Especially those Nikon cameras spelled C-A-N-O-N. Okay, so that's maybe a little bit beyond the first time as a starting point for a new camera kit. Yeah. Sarah, what did you start with camera-wise?
My first SLR was actually my dad's old camera, Praktika. I've still got it. Should have got it out, really. Occasionally I get to use it. Occasionally I get a bit of film and stick it in there. But yeah, originally it was just to go alongside my painting and drawing. And then as the years went by and I moved into digital with a Fuji bridge camera and just actually bought a secondhand one for £42 for my grandson for his 7th birthday. Because he's really interested in photography and nature and wildlife. And he was thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
Good. So if you hang on to it for 100 years, it could be worth £468,000 in the future.
If you don't wear them out. That was, I couldn't pass on mine to him because I wore them out.
It's called patina.
The other bit of news we were looking at, there's been quite a few competitions of some quite important ones have been coming through. The one you saw was Landscape Photographer of the Year, wasn't it, Ian? That was the one you were...
Yeah, so anyone who does sort of follow landscape photography in the UK will probably be pretty familiar with this one. It's the one that's sort of founded by Charlie Waite, famous landscape photographer, the Take a View competition, Landscape Photographer of the Year. I think it's in its 13th year now. Yeah, the winner's been announced. So the overall winner was an image by Chris Frost. And it's a wonderful woodland scene with the hint of sort of mist and this wonderful wild garlic in the foreground. And I'm sure you'll put it up on the screen.
Yeah, bring it up now.
It's a fantastic image. And then there was an image by Lee Dory that won the Classic View. And I remember it's called, he titled it Roman Road. And it was another sort of woodland scene with this muddy track and some reflections and again a little bit of mist. There's a theme with the mist, I think.
The one that won Ian was at a nice slant as well. It was a low level.
It was, yeah,
like you were looking up a hill towards into the woods, so it was a different view, really.
Yeah, I think a worthy winner as well, because I mean it's difficult. I mean the tens of thousands of entries And there'll be hundreds of images within that that I'm sure would be worthwhile of winning it. But I do personally, I think the winner is a fantastic image. And in previous years, I've personally been a bit critical, if you like, and gone, wow, how's that one sort of thing. I mean, last year's one was one of the Scottish Highlands. With some frost in the some ice spikes in the foreground, and compositionally it was a really strong image, but I felt the light was quite flat and it just didn't do it for me, but it won overall. So this is the thing with competitions, it's not going to appeal to everyone, but from what I'm seeing on in the landscape bubble through Twitter and the social media, is I've not heard anyone say that this image is this year, oh, that's rubbish. Everyone's sort of saying what a beautiful image it is, and I tend to agree.
It's pretty cracking.
And it's got him £10,000 as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things with those images is they're this year, and I think you can see it in quite a lot of the images, is they've been very inviting. And maybe that's a perspective on how a lot of us have been feeling this year, that we need to be held, we need a bit of comfort. So those landscapes that draw us in, and that's where the photographer's skill comes in, because you're looking to find that view that gives an image to bring people right into it and feel that you are there in that moment.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. I mean, that's a brilliant point from Sarah. I think if you last year's winner had a bit of tension in it, if you like. Photographers do refer to tension sometimes in images, which is not a bad thing, but definitely had some tension with the sort of the ice spikes in it, a little bit uncomfortable. Whereas, Chris Frost's image with the mist and the wild garlic and that, it's very tranquil. And with everything that's going on in the world at the minute, the judges will be feeling that as well. So that they were probably looking for images that, made them feel a little bit better about themselves with everything that's going on at the moment. So, it's a really good point, I think.
Okay. Well, I think it's the main drive behind an awful lot of my work is to try and get the emotional connection that I feel across to the viewer, so they feel that connection too and can somehow feel as comforted or as joyous as I do in that moment.
I suppose, Damien, you would have liked it better if there'd been a puddle or something involved in the picture. You could have got a reflection that you would have.
Well, there was in one of them. Reflections, yes. I like a bit of water or whatever. But
it was
really comforting is a good word. It was a nice woodland scene and a feeling of, working towards something, going up towards something. I mean, as many woods I've been to where you have that feeling. So it was an interesting one. Winner.
You were going to say, Neil?
There was a picture right up Damo's street. There's one, it looks like Chinatown, corner of Chinatown with a big puddle in the middle of the street. It's right up his street, that is.
Yeah. Street photography with a puddle, that sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, but the contrast to that, quite starkly, was Damien. You found another competition that you thought might be interesting in getting involved with.
Yes, I thought of you on this one, Martin.
Thank you.
It was for the love of concrete, a competition for the love of concrete, and quite an international competition where they were taking pictures of how concrete shapes the world and how to put it into a very nice, beautiful setting. And I just thought of you, Martin.
I know, it's strange. Yeah, the number of concrete pillars that I've put up that I thought were quite beautiful at the time, but never went around and took a photograph of it. I know I was missing out somewhere. So yes, if you look on here, as you can see, a concrete photographer of the year. So yeah, again, but some of the images are quite startling, and it's surprising how something as harsh and unforgiving as concrete, with the right photographer, can actually look pretty amazing. I think some of the work that our friend from last week, Luke, has done with that relating to his dance and form, which shows that off quite well. So yes, all these are places well worth having a look at. These competitions, it might give you an idea to improve your own photographs or try something new My biggest problem is always trying to see these wonderful compositions. I don't, my eye isn't that good, and I don't see where people suddenly come up with a beautiful image. I thought, well, I was there yesterday and I didn't see that. Well, what's wrong with me? So I keep looking at all these beautiful pictures thinking, I'm going to try and copy that somewhere, at least do, if I do a reasonable copy of it and it looks good, then I might not be doing too bad. All right. The last issue I wanted to just bring up was, I don't know whether you've seen this, but I'll show this website. It's about a young man who takes photographs of fighter planes by hanging out the back door of a C-130 Hercules. And as you can see here in the pictures, we were saying the other week about taking risks when you take your photographs. But luckily, he is strapped in. He's not just sitting there. And if you look at, if you follow the link on this website, some of the pictures are quite amazing. So we say about taking an unusual photograph. Here's one at 10,000 feet with four jets buzzing around the back of this plane, and him using little hand signals to say, no, go left a bit, go right a bit, go up and down. You know, it's, I'd like to see some more of the photographs. So have a quick look at that site.
I was going to say, that takes me back to Moose Peterson, aviation photographer I saw at the photography show a couple of years ago. He did a lot of that photography from within planes, yeah. You know, and he said that he would physically ache afterwards because he was strapped in, and obviously he's trying to hold a pose with the camera and he's been thrown around, and he said afterwards he would feel, you know, physically beaten up,
yeah.
just and that, you know, just going up in the air to do some photography. It sounds, you know, straightforward, but obviously it's not.
No, aviation photography is a real skill and art in itself. But I say, if you just look, you can just look where this guy literally sitting on the tail rack, feet out over the edge, just sitting there taking photographs. It's great. It's one of, yeah, something that I would definitely love to do that. That would be right up my street. So yes, have a look at that as well. So that's the news items that we saw this week that interested us. Any items like that you come across yourselves, please send them in. Send us a link, send us an email, or go into the Slack room, drop down a note and just say, oh, I saw this of interest, and we'll follow up and have a look at it as well. So what we're going to do now is have a look at some new gear and bits and keep that we've seen made announcements in the last few weeks. The first thing we're going to start off with, and I suppose this is why we've allowed Neil in tonight, is Nikon have actually announced their two new cameras that have been rumored for quite some time now. So Neil, would you like to tell us about this these new Nikons?
So I wouldn't say they're as much new as more of an update. When they released the Z6 and Z7 nearly 2 years ago now, Nikon was seen to have missed on a few opportunities. The biggest complaint you hear of generally is it only had one card. So what they've tried to do is address a lot of these things and update the Z6 and Z7 in performance and features. So they've put in two card slots. So now you've got a CF Express or QXD card and an SD card in there, which they had a lot of criticism for. They've put in dual processors as well. So the X-Speed 6 processor that's in the Z6, that we now have two dual X-Speed 6 processors in the Z6-2 and in the Z7. So a lot of the improvements that you see in the Z6, two are exactly the same as the Z7. They've improved the 4K video, 60 frames a second 4K video, where you don't need a fan like the Canon, where it doesn't overheat. They've changed the battery as well to try and eke out a few extra shots on the system itself. A lot of it, like I say, is the same. They've improved the eye detection. They've added animal eye detection in there, as well as a couple of methods of eye detection. So instead of having full frame, they've also made it specific wide area eye detection. So you can isolate somebody in a frame and track them or track their eye within that frame. So there are some good things they've done. A lot of the processor stuff has increased the buffers. So the buffer on, I'm trying to think what it was on the Z6. Can't remember. It was something like 40 shots on the Z6 is now 124 shots. And at 14 frames a second, which is up from the 12 frames a second it was, you know, that only gives you about 8 seconds. So in, if you're doing things where you've got a lot of movement, sport, or maybe animal, birds or something, that's pretty useful there. I mean, I've seen people talking about landscapes and 14 frames a second, but I don't know where, I've never seen a landscape move that fast at all. But so they've done a lot of good improvements on it. As a Nikon user, will I be updating this Z6? I don't think so. It doesn't draw me enough. The sensor's the same. Yeah, it's quicker. The tech part of me says, yeah, I'd like the extra 2 frames per second, but is it really going to affect what I do? No, I mean, I shoot a bit of sport photography and 12 frames a second is enough for what I do.
I mean, that's the important question though, really, isn't it? Is someone like yourself who owns the original, you know, is it enough of an upgrade to upgrade? I mean, have Nikon missed the boat in terms of, you know, maybe doing something like Apple does with like an upgrade program? You know, if they offered you a decent price for your original, would that be enough of an incentive to, because they're not cheap cameras, are they, Dave? I mean, only 2 years ago, if you've dropped, two grand nearly on a camera, I mean, 2 years later, there's not many people that are in that position to go, yeah, I'll just buy the Mark II version.
And 2 years later, you're dropping not just 2 grand, you're dropping a bit more.
Yeah.
Is it also done, though, to entice people into the mirrorless system away from their older Nikons? Is that, that's another part of it?
They're doing a, so I know, I think it's in Germany I saw, they're doing a trade-in program. So you can take in your old camera, they'll give you a price for it and do that against the trade-in. It's not as good as the trade-in program they had before, where you could take in any camera and they would give you 200 euros off your camera. So you could take in an old, some camera that's 20 years old. As long as it was still working, they'd give you a trade-in on it.
Or a burnt-out Canon R5, something like that, you know?
Yeah, anything like that, yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a suite of lenses to go with that as well. Is there a new fitting to fit in with the lenses as well?
Yeah, it's the same mount on the lens as previous, exactly the same as the Z mount. They're slowly releasing new lenses. They're saying they're going to release another 8 lenses next year for the Z mount. There's a, I think it's a 150-600 that's coming, I think I saw, or something in that range. That's quite interesting. But as somebody who has F-mount lenses, I don't really want to buy a Z-mount lens that already fits on my Z camera in the same sort of range. It needs to have that much more improvement to it. One thing probably that I would like with this is the, what they call the blackout. So when you switch the camera on, the speed at which the electronic viewfinder comes up, the time between doing things when it blacks out for that split second, apparently that's vastly improved. That would be kind of a nice thing.
Is that because there's an issue about the batteries? Do you tend to turn the camera off in between?
I do tend to have mine set so that it goes to sleep. I mean, I run it in airplane mode all the time so that you don't lose anything with the Bluetooth or anything like that. It's all turned off. I get probably three, four e-shots out of it. So I usually have a spare battery hanging about. Yeah. The new one as well, they've launched a battery grip, which they were criticized for not having with the old one. Right. Got a battery grip with controls on. And also the other difference they've done to try and get over all this battery life is they've made it so you can charge in camera. So you can stick a battery pack on the side of it and charge, run it off the battery pack or charge the camera as you're using it. So they have done some good improvements to it. But yeah, as a Z6 owner, Z6 II, I think I'll wait.
I think it's quite a clever move because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Canon, and you know, regardless of, you know, the heating issues and everything, generally, you know, the R5 is being praised as a, you know, pretty decent camera at the end of the day. So I think Nikon had to do something, and I think they've probably got other stuff in the pipeline, but whilst that's still in development, you know, because I'm sure they've got like a D4 mirrorless equivalent in the pipeline, but you know, whilst that's still coming along, I think to have you know, a little refresh on these cameras is not a bad thing. And it might, you know, as you say, for someone who's already got a Z6 or a Z7, it's not necessarily aimed at them, but for someone who maybe has got D700 or whatever they call them, D750, who's thinking to step into mirrorless, this would be a good starting point. And I think they're smart by, you know, actually these were the issues with the Mark One, and this is what we've tried to address, without completely revamping it, changing the body, you know, and giving them too much to do. It's a nice incremental update.
The question I'd like to raise is that obviously Sony grabbed a bit of a lead with the mirrorless camera when they brought out the A7, and took that forward and really sort of seemed to have caught Canon and Nikon and people like that on the hop a little bit. And they've had that lead for a while, but it surprised me that there's no, I suppose what you're trying to look at is a pro version of the Sony, that it doesn't have twin cards. It's not considered as the same weatherproofing that the more professional cameras from the Canon and Nikon range. I wonder why Sony sort of seemed to have dropped the ball on that. They should have really been ahead of this, I would have thought. What's your thoughts?
A very different market. They very quickly found that an awful lot of people were using the mirrorless kit, and particularly the A7 range, for film work, videography. And one of the reasons I moved away from Sony was because I couldn't get the kind of telephoto lens for the mirrorless camera system direct from them. I mean, they are now bringing in those telephoto lenses, but in their G lens range that are, you know, pretty much just as pricey, if not more pricey, than some of the Canon top range prime lenses. So they've pushed some of their market away, I feel, but they're attracting in new areas of the market. So an awful lot of their own lenses, and also the manufacturers that make lenses very specific for Sony, are all working on cine lenses. And that seems to be one of the primary areas of that sector now.
All right. And Neil, how silent are these new cameras? Are they pretty much almost inaudible?
Well, if you run it in silent photography mode, it is pretty much, there's virtually nothing. In fact, I used it for the first time a few weeks back at a rugby match, and I didn't realise how many photos I'd taken, because you don't have that.
Clack, clack, clack.
Exactly, yeah. It goes off. There is a tiny, tiny noise, but it's really not noticeable at all.
Because there must be certain scenarios when you're taking pictures that you don't need to, you know, making that clacking noise and the shutter dropper every time can be really distracting. I suppose sports events and stuff like that, where you just can't afford to do that.
Well, the nice thing with it, I find, and I've recently I customized a lot of the menu on there, which I hadn't done before. I'd seen a YouTube video on it and went, oh, okay, that's a good idea, because it has this nice feature where the customized menu swaps depending whether you're on doing video or stills. So you can have two menu, completely different menus set up for it. And I just put in the silent photography in there and a couple other things. And yeah, the silent, I don't know why I haven't used it before. I went out and did some focus stacking today, which is something new for me. And that was pretty cool as well. I mean, and I'm only talking about the photography side of the camera. The Z6 is really aimed at media, sort of videographers and photography. In fact, I think the Z6 II has a new feature where You can take the stills, and in the background, it's doing a video at the same time. So you're actually capturing both things. So one card in the camera will capture the video, and the other card is taking your stills.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to have hours and hours of photographs of going all over the place.
And videos, and yeah. Well, you need those 1 terabyte cards you were talking about a few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, there's two things I find interesting about this release, though. There's the battery grip. Like, mirrorless is, you know, we're trying to go smaller, and then we want to stick a battery grip on it to make it bigger. And then there's the dual card issue. I'm like, I wonder what percentage of people will actually gonna. There's so much bitching and moaning when the Mark One came out that it only had one card slot. I reckon of the people that do actually buy the Mark Two, there'll be like 5% of people that will actually use both card slots. It's nuts.
There's a huge amount of people bitching and moaning about it. Why?
But I bet a good percentage of people won't use both slots.
And if they do, it's probably just for backup, and they'll never look at the images on it.
It does make me think whether they could have, you know, kept the price of the Z6 Mark II down by making it one slot, and with the Z7 being more of a, you know, the more pro version, if you like, put the dual slots in that one.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were some very heavy marketing meetings, hours and hours discussed whether we should go one slot or two.
Two cameras are pretty much identical.
Yeah, in terms of body, yeah.
It really is the sensor.
Yeah, so from a manufacturing point of view, it's easier just to keep them identical. Yeah.
Okay. My Fuji is dual card, but it's dual SD card. And I thought it was a bit weird at first. I thought, well, what am I going to do with this? But I can set it to different things. So, for instance, when we're on holiday, I set it so that it will use both card slots one after the other. And that means I can just take out a bunch of cards with me and not worried about having to take a laptop, because I'm just keeping everything on the card storage. But at home, I can do things where I can set one to take just stills and the other one to take video, which I also find really useful because it's separating those out. Mm. Or you can do it as the backup. And a lot of pros do say that is one of the best ways to do it, because if one card fails, you know, and you're halfway through a wedding shoot, I mean, not at the moment, in the current times, but one card fails, the other has still got those shots in. I'm sure we've all had cards that you take it out, pop it in the computer, and no, nothing there.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's definitely worth doing, but I just wonder how many people would actually use them, considering the amount of noise there was when they first got released, that there was only one card slot.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure that conversation will continue. As soon as you get your R6 or R7, Neil, we can bring you back for a full depth in review of the cameras. Just let us know.
And the battery life on the R5 is terrible though. So.
Yeah.
You had to get that in at the end there. So.
Yeah, of course.
Just going back on the battery real quickly.
I'm rising to the bait.
I don't think anything could be quite as bad as the only Sony A6000, which I do still have, but I've actually got 4 batteries for that, and it can go through them at 8 knots. Yeah. Bonkers. Yeah. They've improved it, but bonkers.
Yeah, the cameras are getting lighter and lighter, and then the backpack you have to put on your shoulders is bigger and bigger, you know. So.
The little generator.
The other big item of news this week was the new Photoshop. Which has come out. Is it Photoshop 2021? Is that the title of it? Ian, you were looking at this. What did you find? And there's one very particular item which has caused a bit of upset in the community.
Yeah, two things from me. One, from a personal note, is that I recently updated my computer. And just as well I did, because I fired up, I still kept the old laptop because I find it useful for tethering. And I fired it up the other day, and Adobe told me there was an update. So I thought, oh, yeah, I might as well do the update while I'm on there. And the new version of Photoshop requires macOS 10.14. So I couldn't run that on the laptop. So good job I upgraded when I did. But yeah, there's been a lot of... I haven't tried it myself, but I've seen other friends that have tried it is this sky replacement tool within Photoshop, and from the results I've seen, it looks very good and it's very easy to use. And there's been a lot of talk on Twitter in terms of, you know, should we be using it? You know, it's not the, you know, it's not true to photography. And is it, I just thought it's an interesting discussion point. It's not something that I would personally want to use, but equally, you know, we've been manipulating photos for years, not just in Photoshop, but going back to the darkroom. So, it, you know, is it any worse than dodging and burning or cloning something out? Or
Neil, you could have replaced that sky behind you with a plain blue sky and got rid of all that coloured stuff that's in the way there, you know?
Yeah, I did give it a quick go. I saw a really quick video on it, and I think it took about 3 clicks to replace the sky. It was super, super easy, and the results were very good. I put the pictures up in the Slack room.
And I'll show them up now, yep.
It was really, really easy. A little bit more work on the photo, and I could probably made it look a bit better. But they even, the video I saw, that the adjustments you can do actually even allow the change in the temperature of the foreground as well, so you can match it to the sky. So there's obviously a lot of thought gone into it, but I'm kind of with Ian, you know, it's kind of nice to do. I can imagine, you know, if you could make somebody's wedding picture a nice blue sky rather than the grey one, they'd probably prefer it. But is it real? No, it's not real true.
But then, as we time is money. If you've got 30 or 40 wedding photographs taken on a dull day, being able to put a blue sky in a matter of a few clicks to each one could make a big difference on a commission like that. So it's also it comes back to the Instagram crowd, doesn't it? That all of a sudden you can take a fairly mundane picture on your phone or whatever and turn it into some kind of classic. But I noticed when I was looking at there's a lot of stock photographs as clouds, aren't there, in their library. I wonder how quickly, it's a bit like PowerPoint when you soon recognised all the backgrounds. You think, I know that cloud. That's a Photoshop. Yeah, we all become like bingo, spot the Photoshop background, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
it'll cause people problems if they try to put any of those images in for a competition.
Oh, yes.
It's got to be your own work. You're just not allowed to do stuff like that.
Yeah, especially if it's a non-destructive, if it's a out of the camera picture that they're looking for.
My biggest problem at the moment, and Dodsey knows this, is that Adobe's getting bloated now. The latest stuff that came down, and you're quite right, once it had connected up with the cloud, it sped up a lot. But I'm still finding Lightroom a bit clunky, especially. Yeah. I like Lightroom, but I do a final polish in Photoshop. But it's clunky how it links together, and sometimes it hangs and it crashes. For such a suite of programs, I just think they're getting a little bit difficult to use on the edges. I don't know if you.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because I did something in the Lightroom, the mobile version, the cloud version. I don't know which version you use. Is it the classic you use Lightroom, or?
I'm using the new Lightroom one.
Yeah, sort of the minimalistic type one. I don't know if you noticed, they changed the shortcut. So I went to do Command E to take it into Photoshop.
Yes, that's right. You've got to shift.
And now it's Command Shift E. I mean, why do they do things like that? It's so frustrating.
Well, I have spent all day today fighting with the new Adobe Creative Cloud, and it keeps signing me out and crashing Photoshop. So I'll be lucky if I get anything edited before tomorrow. It's causing me a massive nightmare, and I don't really know what's going on with it.
Are you having the same problem? I thought it was just me that it was just crashing, but if you're having that, I just find little things in it are now not as smooth as their first were.
No. Yeah. I'm working on Windows on the PC, and, you know, as much as I would love a Mac, I'm going to be honest with you, I can't afford it. But Adobe very much started with Apple Mac, And that was where I first found it. And then it became quite a universal program. And now it's becoming much more Mac orientated. And I do wonder whether I'm starting to see little glitches because I'm on a PC. I mean, everything on the cloud thing, when you open it up, and when you open up Photoshop as well, it's talking about numerous tutorials and things you can do on an iPad. Well, I don't have an iPad.
Yes, I saw that. I mean, I'm having to borrow, my Mac is out for repair at the moment, and I'm using a Windows. And again, I was a bit taken aback. All they were telling us about on the tutorials, Sarah, is how to use it with an iPad.
I'm really disappointed in that, because I think I think you're just cutting off a whole area of the public who would love to be doing artistic photography and for all manner of reasons can't afford Mac.
Yeah, that's always been that kind of issue about Mac PC. And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Adobe originally spiral out of the Apple group?
It did. Yes, it did. So it was very much a sort of package that kind of came together, because Apple was all about design and photography. And I first used it when I was doing graphic design work. But it was a very different setup, very different setup. So.
And then there seemed to be a few years of almost spats between Apple and Adobe, where they weren't happy with the processing that was going on. And now, as I say, it seems to maybe starting to turn full circle, that they're going back more towards the Mac side. I suppose it's to do with, I'd say, with the new iPads and the iPhones, that iOS system is I think there are quite a number of competitors in the iPad market for that kind of work, as Affinity is one, isn't it, and Illuminator and people where Photoshop seems to struggle a bit, so maybe that's why
I think that they're playing catch up in that area, and don't worry about it, Sarah, you're not missing out, because the Photoshop for iPad's crap. And if Adobe want to line up behind Road to Light for sponsorship, then fair enough.
We say it as we think it here. It's that's people's experience.
And... Oh, that's good. That's good.
It was interesting. I noticed the same thing with the. I mean, I have an iPad, and I use Lightroom on it, but I won't touch Photoshop on it. And when I opened Photoshop for the first time, they were telling me about all these new features on Photoshop for iPad, and I just went skip.
So, yeah.
I've had so many problems with it. I went to open an image from photos with it from on the iPad. It told me this is not a supported format. It was just a photo from the photos library, and I'm like, this cannot be right, Adobe. It's not good. I mean, going back to the sky thing, I mean, you got me thinking, Martin. I think actually from a practical standpoint, actually, if you've got to do like property photography. And you've got a grey, boring day, and you've got to sell that property. Yep. That the sky replacement thing could be really useful from that point of view.
Yeah.
Because you've got one opportunity to go there, and if it's a grey, miserable day, then
you've still got to take the shot.
If everyone can replace the sky or remove objects with just one click, is the software manufacturer not ending up putting photographers and designers who have worked long and hard and trained hard out of business? A little bit like when I've done a wedding shoot before, and people have said, oh, but you should see what so-and-so got on their Apple whatever it is, and I think, well, that's fine, but if you want to blow it up onto a big canvas or anything, it's not gonna look great. And it's all about this sort of quick, got to get it out, got to get it done. And it's taking some of the artistry out of it, but we're just focusing on small images, and it might look fine on that, but if you look in detail, you're losing out. And I do think it's going to take an awful lot away from photographers who do that kind of corporate work as part of their livelihood.
Well, I should think if they're professionals, Sarah, they'll actually encompass it. If it can make their life easier and better and quicker, they might find it might be a way of doing it. As you say, taking a house on a dull, boring day in Tuesday in Surbiton and making it look like a bright Saturday morning in Jamaica, it's going to, you know, help sell that house. So, yeah, but photography's always been under that kind of pressure, hasn't it? As the technology has got simpler and simpler to use, the skills of the photographer have been downgraded somewhat. That anyone can grab an iPhone now and take an award-winning shot for Landscape of the Year. But the professional photographer is still going to have his niche market. And I think when you see a lot of the dross that's produced, you understand why there are still some very good photographers like yourself and the other gents on here tonight. The only other piece of news that I was going to bring up, but I'm actually going to save it for a next show, is the iPhone, obviously.
Okay, just on the Sky replacement bit though, I think.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think Neil's picture is a really good example of, you know, I've been in situations where the Sky's done that, and that feeling of being there and capturing something like that is just awesome, and that stays with you. Doing a couple of clicks in Photoshop does not replace it.
Yeah.
That for me, that, you know, being able to capture that in camera and experience it, and you know, when you look back at an image like that, you think, yeah, that was, wow, that was such a fantastic morning, and yeah, Photoshop can't replace that.
You live in heaven, Neil. What we're grape and vineyards around the place and stuff. I mean,
no, that was grey skies. He did that in Photoshop.
Yeah, that was. That was down at Basild and Saltmarsh, and you know, bit of Photoshop, bit of sky replacement. What have you got? You know, okay, yeah. So we'll have a separate photo show about the iPhone. I think we all need to get one, have a look at one first, have a play around with it. From what I can tell from the press releases, the photographs are stunning, absolutely stunning.
Who's ordered one then?
Yeah, I'm ordering a 12 Pro Max Plus X, whatever it's called, next week when it comes out.
So you went for the cheap one, then?
I'm going to go for the cheap one, yeah. Fully maxed out. Five.
The one that fits nicely in your pocket.
Who's going to loan me one?
Well, that's the other thing, Damon. I'm going to replace all my trousers with work trousers, cargo pockets, so it won't be a problem. Somewhere to put it, you know. So
I thought you was just pleased to see me.
That's right, yeah. My favourite designer now is Scruffs and Snickers. So, okay, that's our news for this week. Unfortunately, we're going to have to split this show into two sections, part one and part two. Part two will be all about our discussion and interview with Sarah Longies. But unfortunately, because of the bandwidth restrictions we have, we can't show this all as one show. So please tune in to part two and listen to the fascinating discussion with Sarah Longs. See you all in part two. I'd like to say a quick mention to our sponsors, TSO Hosts, who provide all the services that we need to get these shows out to you all. They provide all the server bandwidth we need, as well as support for our systems. They're a great company to work with. I have my own site with them. And if you need anything to do with web, design, domain names, hosting, anything like that at all, please contact them. And if you mention BTN20, they'll even give you a big discount off your first orders. Our other main sponsor here is IMN Max here in Birmingham, who are able to service and repair and upgrade any Apple kit or Apple machines that you've got. And they can even provide some really good refurbished machines with excellent value for money. And they deal with any kind of problem, actually. That's a nice bunch of guys. Just give them a ring if you have an issue, anything to do with your Macs, and I'm sure they can help you out.